as many states refused to cooperate in examining voter returns. Many in the media criticized Trump on the grounds that it was ridiculous for the winner of an election to charge voter fraud and demand an investigation, as if the President of the United States could not have an objective interest in fair elections, or on the grounds that investigations of voter fraud were implicitly racist, a covert way to purge Hispanic voters from the rolls, which was ludicrous. On January 28th, Trump issued an executive order temporarily banning the admission to the United States of travelers from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. They were all, apart from Iran, countries in some state of civil war. There were immediate disputes about the order's legality, and the Democrats went judge shopping among the West Coast left-wing benches to find a federal judge who would purport to block the imposition of the executive order. The previous administration's Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, declined to execute the president's order and was fired. A Washington state judge did find fault with the order, and the Democrats undoubtedly hoped Trump would just ignore the ruling, as President Andrew Jackson had when he said of Chief Justice Marshall, "He has made his decision, now let him enforce it." This would have enabled them to torque up talk of impeachment, which was already being bandied about by the Democrats, focusing now on Trump's alleged sinister relations with Russia, and dark claims that he had colluded with the Russian regime to sandbag the Clinton campaign through WikiLeaks and cyberhacking, and as yet unspecified skullduggery. Trump abided by the judge's order and instead imposed his policies when travelers reached the United States, rather than forbidding them to come from their originating countries, and waited for the Supreme Court to rule on the dispute. He nominated Judge Neil Gorsuch to fill the vacancy on the high court, left by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia a year before. Gorsuch would be confirmed, shoring up the thin conservative majority at the Supreme Court, and thus saving conservative America from one of its worst nightmares, the possibility of a liberal court that would give a blank check to liberal judges, the bureaucracy, and Democratic presidents to override the legislative branch and effect any progressive measures they wished. Riots and demonstrations erupted in many parts of the country and a few places overseas to protest Trump's travel and immigration policies. There were sit-ins and traffic blockages at airports that greatly inconvenienced the traveling public. The theme was that Trump was a racist and that he was reversing the openness of America to the world that was one of the foundations of the country. Democratic Senate leader Chuck Schumer, choking back crocodile tears, called Trump's executive order mean-spirited and un-American, claiming solidarity with the Statue of Liberty, which Schumer claimed was also weeping over the temporary ban. On January 31st, Trump extended Obama's LGBTQ workplace protection for employees of federal contractors. He issued a statement saying that he was determined to protect the rights of all Americans, including the LGBTQ community, and is respectful and supportive of LGBTQ rights, just as he was throughout the election. He said he was proud to have been the first ever GOP nominee to mention the LGBTQ community in his acceptance speech, pledging then to protect the community from violence and oppression. Polls indicated the majority of Americans supported his crackdown on travelers from terrorism-sponsoring or infested countries, and his LGBTQ order sharply undercut the pussy-hatted caterwauling of the women's marchers. He was off to a predictably stormy, but not a bad, start. In the first few months of his new presidency, practically nothing was accepted as normal and unexceptionable. And as Schumer and his Democratic colleagues in the Senate were obstructing and delaying every cabinet and senior departmental appointment that came before them, the Obama holdovers were making government as difficult as possible and leaking like waterfalls to the anti-Trump media, which was practically all of the media except for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and Fox News. Like almost every controversy involving Trump, the partial travel ban receded from the distracted consciousness of the country after a few weeks, as the hyenas and the media were unable to sustain the story and moved on to other subjects in their litany of what Trump dismissed, often rightly, as fake news. On February 1st, the contents of a rather heated telephone call with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull were leaked, in which Trump became audibly irritated over Turnbull's insistence that he honor Obama's informal commitment to accept 1,200 refugees from the Middle East, who were being provisionally sheltered on the small Pacific island nation of Nauru. Australia was discouraging trans-Pacific people smuggling by not admitting undocumented people and moving them offshore where they could be assessed by immigration authorities. Turnbull's deal with Obama was that, in exchange, Australia would accept some Central Americans attempting illegal entry into the United States. And Turnbull emphasized to Trump that the United States did not have to accept any of the people on Nauru. Immigration officials could screen them and reject them. But it would be up to the United States to maintain them where they were or move them elsewhere. The revelation of the transcript of the conversation, a disgraceful betrayal by disloyal White House insiders, made the two leaders appear to be engaged in a cynical game at the expense of the pathetic fugitives from the distressed Middle East. This wasn't an entirely fair impression, and like all these incidents, it passed quickly. Also on February 1st, hoodlums in ninja costumes smashed parts of buildings and set fires on the Berkeley campus of the University of California in protest at the proposed address of controversial gay free speech firebrand Milo Yiannopoulos, invited by one of the campus clubs. Antifa, which took a lead role in this protest and in violent opposition to Trump, was a ragtag group of militant anarchists, anti-capitalists, and neo-Marxists who purported to see fascism, by those with whom they disagreed, in the exercise of the First Amendment rights to freedom of assembly and speech. It took an unconscionable time for leading Democrats to disavow this riffraff. More damaging was the Washington Post leak on February 9th that National Security Advisor General Michael Flynn had discussed with the Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak the possibility that the Trump administration might reduce the sanctions President Obama had imposed on Russia for its alleged interference in the United States elections. Flynn had denied this, and the Post story indicated that there was, as Trump would soon claim, to fierce objections but subsequent partial vindication, some official surveillance of his campaign or transition team prior to his inauguration. The Post story revealed that former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates had warned that Flynn could be vulnerable to blackmail, indicating questionable and quite possibly illegal official telephone intercepts on Trump campaign personnel, as well as illegal post-inauguration leaks of confidential information to the media. 5 days later, February 20th, Flynn resigned, acknowledging that he had had some telephone discussions with the Russian ambassador, that the issue of the sanctions had arisen, and that in the fast pace of events, he had inadvertently misinformed the vice president-elect, who had accordingly assured the media that there had been no such discussions. In a statement, Flynn said that he had apologized to the president and vice president, and that his apology had been accepted. This turn of events was a legitimate embarrassment for the administration, and was enthusiastically amplified by the political and media opposition to lend credence to the vague but constant allegations of a dishonest, possibly treasonous, and implicitly eminently impeachable relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. General H.R. McMaster, a respected military intellectual, replaced Flynn at the National Security Council on February 20th. The Flynn story would not go away soon or easily. Another instant media addiction that lingers still, though Trump has taken precautions to reduce his vulnerability to it, has been the practice of seizing on the least ambiguity in Trump's remarks to misrepresent his comments as indicative of his ignorance or bigotry. His notorious imprecision with some facts, as well as his infamous truthful hyperbole, opened the door to this problem, and the media rushed through it. On February 2nd, he said that he was very proud that there was now a museum on the National Mall in Washington for African American history, the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture. While listing prominent African Americans featured in the museum's exhibits, including Martin Luther King, Harriet Tubman, and Rosa Parks, Trump said of famous abolitionist Frederick Douglass that he is someone who has done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more. CNN, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and the full gamut of other leftist anti-Trump outlets gratuitously seized upon this as evidence that Trump had no idea who Douglass was. His knowledge of Douglass's career may not be extensive, but no such inference was justified, and the media's overzealous treatment of the story was compounded by its implication that such ignorance was further proof that Trump was a racist, a demonstrably false conclusion. Similarly, when Trump said to the press during the visit to Washington of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on February 15th that he was looking at both one-state and two-state solutions to the Israel-Palestine conflict, the anti-Trump media raised the alarm, for no reason whatever, that he had abandoned the two-state option. On February 18th, Trump spoke at one of his heavily attended rallies in Florida and listed places in Europe struggling to assimilate a large influx in refugees. In addition to mentioning Germany, Belgium, and France, he said, "You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. They took in large numbers of refugees. They're having problems like they never thought possible." Nothing noteworthy had happened in Sweden the night before, and Swedes and Trump's domestic opponents became very exercised that he had invented a terrorist attack in Sweden. He eventually clarified that he misspoke and was referring to having seen a Fox News report the night before that represented Sweden as the rape capital of Europe because of the recent admission of 350,000 Middle Eastern migrants. In their typical rush to rebuff the president, his opponents overplayed their hand, essentially painting Sweden as a perfect example of refugee integration. 2 days later, riots broke out in a predominantly immigrant-populated suburb of Stockholm. Trump avoided comment. When Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe arrived on February 10th, the media fussed about the extended handshake they had, 19 seconds. It is common practice to extend a handshake for a photo op. Constant camera shutters can be heard in the video during the handshake, so it's reasonable to assume Trump was just posing. That meeting and the visit of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau 3 days later, as well as the Netanyahu meeting, were all very satisfactory. Trump and Trudeau set up a Canada-United States Council for Advancement of Women Entrepreneurs and Business Leaders, a little-noticed debunking of the canard about Trump's supposed misogyny. With their customary priggishness and snobbery, the British, a wide swath of their opinion still irritated at being so thoroughly surpassed by the Americans and world influence, became spontaneously annoyed when their new prime minister, Theresa May, invited President Trump to make a state visit to the United Kingdom later in 2017. A petition signed by 1.8 million Britons asked that the visit be reduced to a simple intergovernmental visit so as not to embarrass the Queen. This was nonsense, as the President of the United States is a chief of state and cannot be and would not consent to be treated as unworthy of meeting the British monarch. In the prevailing circumstances, as Britain began to negotiate its exit from the European Union, it was in no position to slap America in the face, though unfortunately, Trump's domestic opponents were so pathological in their hatred for him that they would relish the office of president being dragged through the international mud as long as it looked bad for Trump. The issue was debated in Parliament on February 20th, with the Speaker of the House of Commons having pandered with silly and unjust remarks about Trump, the notorious racist and misogynist. But the government dismissed the argument as contrary to the British national interest. The atmosphere was further soured by the endless and cheeky comments of the vain and belligerent leftist Muslim mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. Boris Johnson, Britain's redoubtable foreign minister, later said, in one of the finest uses of Twitter, "We will not allow U.S.-UK relations to be endangered by some pompous, puffed-up popinjay in City Hall." It was agreed by May and Trump several months later at the G20 meeting in Hamburg that the president's visit would be deferred to 2018. Trump's cabinet secretaries generally performed admirably, but his lively and chaotic White House staff sometimes seemed composed mostly of members of a floating crap game, as veteran journalist and fair-minded commentator Britt Hume noted. Nevertheless, if the new administration's progress was sometimes forward, sometimes sideways, it took its dynamic lead from the top. Trump was nothing if not hard-working on both domestic issues and foreign affairs. After Iran tested a long-range ballistic missile on February 3rd, Trump warned the country's Islamist regime that it was playing with fire and imposed new sanctions on it. Trump hosted German Chancellor Angela Merkel on March 17th, and they made progress on Germany, representing NATO's second-greatest economy, raising its defense budget to better approximate its NATO commitments. There were problems on the climate side, however, as Merkel was obliged by domestic politics to pitch in with the Greens. Trump did what he could by executive authority alone. He rolled back Obama's transgender bathroom guidelines, leaving such matters to the states on February 22nd. On March 6th, Trump issued a new travel ban order that was less vulnerable legally than the first, though the legal issues around even the first were largely fraudulent. The president controls immigration policy, and it is no business of federal or other judges. But Democrats and pro-Islam activist groups cited comments Trump had made in his campaign about temporarily banning entry by Muslims, a suggestion he had drastically revised and which should have been irrelevant in any event to adjudging the executive order. His opponents wanted the courts to ignore the president's constitutional authority and instead impute to him a violation of religious liberty, which was nonsense, as foreign residents and citizens do not possess religious rights to enter the United States. An Obama law school classmate in Hawaii, whom Obama had appointed to the bench, purported to strike down the revised travel ban on March 16th as it progressed upwards in the court system. Trump eventually included non-Muslim countries, Venezuela and North Korea. And in late November 2017, the High Court tentatively upheld Trump's last formulation of his executive order, deferring a decision on the main issue to its normal place on the court calendar. On February 27, 2017, the House Intelligence Chairman, Republican Congressman Devin Nunes of California, revealed that Congress had no evidence of collusion between Trump and the Russians. On March 4th, the president, as was his custom at this point, announced via Twitter that his communications had been tapped at the Trump Tower and accused his critics, with their endless speculation about Russian collusion, of engaging in McCarthyism. The anti-Trump media responded with its customary wave of incredulous disdain. Trump stuck to his allegation and advised critics to await events. On March 22nd, Nunes affirmed that some transition-era communications of the Trump campaign had been intercepted, putting a rod partially on the backs of the more hysterical anti-Trump media, who had been doing a native rain dance of derision over the Trump tweet of March 4th. On April 6th, Nunes would temporarily retire from direction of the Russian probe by his committee because of complaints that he had shown the president before he had shown his own committee colleagues some of the findings of the committee's investigation, which confirmed Trump's wiretapping claims. This required until December 8th to resolve, when Nunes was completely cleared by the Ethics Committee. It had been another partisan red herring. The Russian question became cloudier when Attorney General Sessions on March 2nd acknowledged that he had spoken casually with Russian officials at large receptions and during the campaign by telephone, that these facts had escaped his memory at his confirmation hearings, and that he had been advised by counsel that the telephone contacts need not be reported for his application for a security clearance. The meetings appeared to have been mere exchanges of pleasantries. But the Washington Post claimed that it had evidence that Sessions had discussed sanctions and campaign matters with the Russian ambassador during the campaign. Sessions denied this forcefully, and as any such information as the Post claimed to have would have been procured illegally, it is of doubtful veracity, especially as Sessions had no authority to speak for Trump during the campaign, and especially not with a foreign ambassador. It was a very clumsy performance by Sessions, and he announced his recusal on the whole Russian matter, leaving the president with no attorney general or deputy attorney general, as he had fired Sally Yates for refusal to carry out his immigration order, immediately involved in the Russian investigation. Trump had nominated Rod Rosenstein as deputy attorney general, but the Senate had not yet confirmed him, though it eventually did by a vote of 94-6. In the meantime, he had a very politically meddlesome and suspect FBI director, James Comey, whose loyalty Trump had good reason to doubt. Trump was very litigious and legally experienced, and he saw at once the problems of the position Sessions had created for him. He would tell the New York Times on July 19th, Sessions should have never recused himself, and if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job, and I would have picked somebody else. Trump told the Times nothing but the truth when he said of Sessions' conduct, it's extremely unfair, and that's a mild word, to the president. At this point, there was the predictable overreaction to Trump's comments, with publicity-addicted posturers in the Congress even sponsoring legislation to protect the attorney general from being fired, as if it were not the express right of the president to fire whomever he wishes in the executive branch. In any event, Trump did not intend to fire Sessions, which would obviously have been unwise at this point, and Sessions soldiered on, giving a passable performance on June 13th when he appeared before the Senate Intelligence Committee and poured cold water on the Russian issue. The Russian collusion argument never had the appearance of anything but a desperately seized canard to harass and defame Trump and distract the new administration from putting its program through, while consoling a sulky Hillary Clinton over her defeat. And that remains the case at time of writing. Meanwhile, Trump spoke well and was generously received when he addressed Congress for the first time on February 28th. He stole the Democrats' clothes in many policy areas and went to considerable and somewhat eloquent lengths to destroy any suggestion that he was anything but a passionate opponent of racial or sex discrimination. The well-applauded appearance of his dazzlingly attractive wife and daughters and daughters-in-law in the gallery enabled the Trump family, in this unique setting, to appear unfazed and somewhat above the controversy that had swirled around them for many months. On March 14th, one of Trump's most rabid detractors, MSNBC's raucously opinionated Rachel Maddow, triumphantly announced that she had a copy of part of Trump's 1995 tax return. Democrats had been demanding sight of his returns, which Trump refused while they were still being audited and in dispute, and various media personnel had publicly asked for the leakage of them. Incitement to criminal behavior. But this was now fairly routine among Trump's enemies. Maddow breathlessly plunged into her revelation on air without analyzing it very much, and it showed that, contrary to New York Times and other claims that Trump had paid no taxes for decades, he had in fact in 1995 paid federal income tax of $38 million. The Democratic assertions for months, such as by Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, that his tax returns would validate the Russian charges, went mercifully quiet. The press was also uncharacteristically quiet about one of the greatest achievements of the administration, which gained steam throughout his first months in office, as Trump began a massive rollback of red tape and regulations, which had an immediate and salutary effect on the health and well-being of American business. On March 28, 2017, Trump repealed Obama's global warming emissions reduction policies, as he considered these punitive to American business and consumers. The move was one that the media could not ignore, but could not praise either. When Trump did finally win plaudits, it was for taking military action against Syria, something approved of by many Democrats and never-Trump Republicans. On April 4th, the embattled Russo-Iranian puppet president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, again used sarin gas on Syrian civilians, a specialty of his late father, and the sort of incident that violated Barack Obama's infamous red line and caused him to huff and puff and abdicate his role of commander-in-chief to Congress and then back down ignominiously deferring to Russia. Trump ordered the firing of 59 cruise missiles from an American warship against a Syrian airfield and gas storage complex 2 days later, after giving a brief warning to Russia, which had personnel in the target area. The cruise missile attack took place while Trump was having dinner with Chinese President Xi Jinping at his Florida home, Mar-a-Lago. The Chinese leader was quite unruffled, as China has no dog in the Middle East hunt, and the visit seemed to go well. On April 13th, Trump approved a military recommendation to drop a 10-ton bomb on an underground ISIS complex in Afghanistan, which destroyed the target and killed at least 92 ISIS terrorists. All polls showed that approval of the president's performance, though lukewarm at about 40%, was twice that of Congress and three times that of the media. His dominance of social media, more than 40 million followers of his Twitter accounts, and the talk radio world allowed Trump to offer his own alternative to the narrative of the New York Times. Rush Limbaugh, who is intelligently pro-Trump, has more than twice as many listeners as the New York Times has readers, and Rush, unlike the Times, focuses almost exclusively on politics. 3 months into his presidency, Trump had already arrayed himself for battle against the establishment and achieved significant victories. But the struggle for mastery in Washington was just beginning. Chapter 11, A Honeymoon of Hand-to-Hand Combat. It was now to be the hour of James Comey, though not in the manner that the tall, publicity-seeking FBI director might have planned. On May 3rd, he testified before the House Judiciary Committee and said that the Bureau had not, in his time, been asked to stop or change the course of an investigation, though advice had sometimes been given, but not more than that. He laid great emphasis on the investigation of Russia's attempted interference in the 2016 election and said that Russia is the greatest threat of any nation on earth. He said they would do this again because of the 2016 election. They know it worked. He did not expand on this and did not claim that Russia had determined the result of the election. He said that Russia should be made to pay a price for its interference. These assertions were all far beyond his remit. It was not the business of the federal police director to pronounce on matters of geopolitical strategy. Even J. Edgar Hoover, who directed the FBI or its previous equivalent for 48 years, left such determinations to the 8 presidents whom he serviced. 6 days later, Comey was fired by Trump very unceremoniously, an event he only learned of by television as he was out of Washington and the president's letter had been delivered to his Washington office, and given the identity of the sender, had not been opened. The FBI director was entitled to greater personal consideration. The White House initially stated that the firing was at the suggestion of the Attorney General and his just-appointed deputy, Rod Rosenstein. Rosenstein had been critical in a memo to Sessions of Comey's conduct in the Clinton investigation. Comey had certainly been presumptuous and inconsistent, even unprofessional. Trump let it be known in interviews that apart from what Rosenstein and Sessions had to say about Comey, Trump was annoyed because although Comey had told him 3 times, as Comey subsequently confirmed, that he, the president, was not a suspect in the Russian investigation, Comey declined to make that point publicly. He was thus effectively facilitating the efforts of the Democrats to immobilize the president and compromise him internationally, and feed the media smear machine by pretending that a Watergate-style evaporation of executive authority was underway. Anti-Trump commentators were predictably eager to make comparisons with President Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre, his firing of the Attorney General and the Special Prosecutor in 1973. These were completely incomparable events, but very few people now remember Nixon's actions with any accuracy. Comey had asked to see Trump, had dinner with him on January 27th, and made clear to the new president that he wished to remain as FBI director. Comey claims Trump asked him for loyalty, and Comey instead promised honesty. Trump was irritated with Comey because he thought the FBI director should be doing more to apprehend and prosecute the leaks within the administration, all of the leaks being criminal offenses. On February 14th, Trump allegedly told Comey that he hoped the FBI director would seek the imprisonment of reporters who were publishing classified information, which they knew to be illegal. In addition, he allegedly said that, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn go." Comey wrote a memo of the conversation for his own files and later testified to Congress, June 8th, that he took Trump's comments as an order to drop the Flynn investigation, though that does not accord with Trump's alleged words or his conduct. But he did not consider that Trump was attempting to obstruct the Russia investigation. Comey asked on March 4th that the Justice Department authorize him to deny publicly that the Obama administration had tapped Trump's telephones at Trump Tower, as Trump had alleged, but permission was denied. And at time of writing, it seems quite likely that Trump's allegation was accurate. As Comey acknowledged in his testimony to Congress on June 8th, he leaked his memo of the February 14th meeting, whose contents Trump disputed, to the New York Times shortly after he was fired, and said his motive was to provoke the appointment of a special counsel. This was slightly incongruous, as he did not allege that he feared Trump was trying to shut down the Russian investigation, and had confirmed that Trump was not a suspect. But the differences between Trump and Comey were numerous, going back to what Trump considered his effort to deliver the election to Clinton, and including Trump's belief that Comey was complicit in perpetuating the made-up story of Russian collusion by refusing to acknowledge publicly that Trump was not under investigation. Trump was also angry, with some reason, with Comey's failure to do anything about illegal leaks from Obama holdovers in the administration. His failure, as Trump saw it, to look seriously at the dubious antics of the Clinton Foundation, and his failure to acknowledge or prevent government surveillance of Trump Tower. On May 12th, Trump tweeted that Comey should hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press. This was a bothersome comment, although Trump may believe that it obliged Comey to be careful in subsequent accounts of their conversations. On June 22nd, 2 weeks after Comey's congressional testimony, faced with a subpoena for production of such tapes, Trump tweeted that he had no idea whether there are tapes or recordings of my conversations with James Comey, but I did not make and do not have any such recordings. A tweeted response was a calculatedly cavalier slap in the face to the militant Democrats on the committee, who reacted rather petulantly. The pugnacious Adam Schiff, Democratic congressman from Hollywood, to whose rabidly partisan and usually foolish collective views he gave unceasing voice, demanded elaboration and said Trump's tweet had made things less and not more clear. Trump ignored Schiff, who was a constant television presence, sanctimoniously implying the president was guilty of outrages almost every night. And Trump had his assistant press secretary say the president's tweet was extremely clear. On May 17th, Trump met with two Russian diplomats and described Comey to them as a nut job, and also mentioned that he had received intelligence that ISIS might try to smuggle bombs onto aircraft and laptops. This was all leaked by White House personnel to the press, who then accused Trump of giving away Israeli intelligence. This backfired on the media when it was pointed out that it ill-behooved the media to incite and publish leaks of confidential information while righteously accusing Trump of causing these indiscretions. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu dismissed suggestions that he had any concerns about what Trump told the Russians, and these complaints quickly vanished. In the Washington jargon of the Times, it was another nothing burger. Comey's predecessor at the FBI and longtime friend and sponsor, Robert Mueller, was appointed special counsel on May 17th by Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein, with authority to look into all aspects of the Russian question. He took over an investigation in progress, and there were triumphant rejoicings from Trump's enemies and groans from his supporters that this would be another endless warlock hunt, such as Archibald Cox and Leon Jaworski conducted against Nixon, Lawrence Walsh against Reagan over the Iran-Contra nonsense, and Kenneth Starr conducted against President Clinton, with an investigation that started with Whitewater and ended with a tawdry affair with an intern. there were not normal grounds to justify such a council at this time, and Sessions' recusal and the malleability of Rosenstein after only a few days in office left Trump rather isolated officially. And if Rosenstein felt compelled to name a counsel, it should not have been someone so closely associated with Comey, whose own conduct was going to require explanation. Mueller aggravated the controversy by recruiting a group of notorious Clintonites for his legal staff, which denied the appearance of an impartial inquiry, and instead made it seem like an anti-Trump fishing expedition, which it almost certainly was, though Rosenstein publicly said that he would not authorize Mueller to go beyond the logical remit of his investigation. President Trump left Washington on May 19th with his wife and an official entourage for his first foreign trip as president amid renewed hysteria and predictions of his impeachment. Nate Silver, ABC News political analyst, said the chances of impeachment were from 25% to 50% on May 22nd, though he offered no opinion on whether such a move would succeed. The firing of the FBI director and the appointment of a special counsel encouraged the media to run with its preferred narrative of a presidency in crisis, but there was no substance to any of it. Just the writhings and thrashings of the endangered and half-decapitated Washington political establishment and its media, Wall Street, Hollywood, and Silicon Valley accomplices. The president made a splash in foreign policy, first by meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on May 16th in the Oval Office, and then by traveling to Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Rome, an interesting and groundbreaking trip between the three Abrahamic religious centers, before appearing at NATO headquarters in Brussels to urge a better effort by the laggard allies to fulfill their duties and military pledges. In Saudi Arabia, the Trump party was greeted with immense deference by the country's 81-year-old monarch, King Salman, and Trump addressed a conference of the Arab states calling for a united effort against terrorism and was well received. The Arab world had not been charmed by Obama's overtures to Iran and found his foreign policy tentative and ambivalent, confusing and worrisome. The Trumps were very generously received in Jerusalem, and the president and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are old friends. Trump also met with the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas and professed cautious optimism about advancing a lasting peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. His Middle East peace representative is his son-in-law Jared Kushner, a much criticized arrangement, but as far as could be determined, the visit went off well at all levels. The meeting in Rome with Pope Francis was cordial and seemed to rebuild the generally good relations between the White House and the Holy See that have existed at least since the time of Pope Pius XII and Franklin Roosevelt, and certainly since the time of Pope John Paul II and President Ronald Reagan, who appointed the first American ambassador to the Holy See. On this occasion, it came to light that Melania Trump is in fact an observant Roman Catholic. Her religion was revealed by the London Daily Mail, which was ironic, as it was from this newspaper that she had recently collected almost $3 million in a libel settlement over the insinuation that she had, in effect, been a prostitute while modeling in New York. She had the Pope bless her rosary and inclined her head respectfully when shaking hands, but did not kiss the Pope's ring as the last Roman Catholic wife of an American president, Jacqueline Kennedy, had done. The meeting in Brussels was a little less convivial, but Trump certainly got his message across. He was emphatic about American faith in NATO, but because he did not specifically mention Clause 5, which states an attack on one member is an attack upon all, there were loud complaints among the domestic opposition commentators that he had undercut and conditionalized the whole alliance. Once again, utter nonsense. The following clause says that each country will decide for itself how to respond to an attack. Even the press had a hard time denying that the president and his family represented the country with dignity and success, and a fine balance between the different religious forces with whose leaders he met. He left Chancellor Merkel and some others with the distinct impression that he would act on his campaign promises not to ratify the Paris Climate Accord, and he followed through on this on June 2nd, shortly after his return to Washington. There was the customary outcry of the fanatical climate lobby, claiming the end was nigh. But the president, Environmental Administrator Scott Pruitt, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and others all explained effectively that the United States was unequivocal in its fight against pollution and the spoliation of resources, but was not prepared to turn its pockets inside out to placate a large number of countries whose ecological performance had been a good deal less distinguished than that of the United States. On May 22nd, while Trump was in the Middle East, there was an Islamist terrorist attack at a pop concert in the British city of Manchester, killing 22 people and injuring 59, many of them youngsters. On June 14th, a far-left activist and Bernie Sanders supporter, James Hodgkinson, launched a terrorist attack on Republican congressmen at a baseball practice in Northern Virginia, seriously wounding Republican House of Representatives Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana and several others. Hodgkinson was killed by Capitol Police and was the only fatality, but it shocked the political community. On May 30th, comedian Kathy Griffin conducted an imitation ISIS-style photo shoot and sent around a picture of the blood-stained, apparently severed head of the president. This was too much even for his more strenuous enemies, and she was roundly condemned as temporarily unhinged as she oscillated between apologies, tearful lamentations that Trump had ruined her, and defiant statements that he was picking on the wrong redhead, and all her life she had been hassled by older white guys. Trump hadn't done anything to her, and when he commented on the incident, he said, quite rightly, that Griffin should be ashamed of herself, especially considering that he was the father of an 11-year-old son who was having a hard time with this. Melania issued a statement that called the photo disturbing, and said it raised questions about Ms. Griffin's mental health, a reasonable inference. On June 15th, CNN's mouthy White House reporter, Jim Acosta, announced that the president had not visited Congressman Scalise after he was shot. In fact, the president and Mrs. Trump did visit him as soon as he could receive visitors. Acosta's report was a complete fabrication, as was the media claim that Trump had moved a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. out of the Oval Office. He had left it in place, but brought back the bust of Winston Churchill that Obama had removed from the White House. There have been endless media efforts to portray Trump as a racist and sexist, sometimes subtly and often not. On June 26th, three CNN journalists were forced to resign after confecting and issuing false stories on the Russia investigation. It was a war of attrition, and the media shed more blood than the president in this battle. But they were dispensable and replaceable media picadors trying to wound and provoke the president. Some of the attacks on the president, like those of Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough on MSNBC, seemed almost demented. On June 20th, there was a special election in Georgia's 6th congressional district to fill the vacancy created by the confirmation of the sitting member, Dr. Tom Price, as Secretary of Health and Human Services. The national media billed the election as a referendum on Trump. Such was their confidence that Trump would not pass such a test. More than $30 million poured in from outside the state to assist the Democratic candidate, but the Republican won easily enough, as Republicans did in other elections at that time. And Trump demonstrated again that those who voted for him remained solidly behind him. The 6th District special election was the most expensive election in the history of the House of Representatives. David Gergen, knowledgeable former aide to Presidents Reagan and Clinton, but now reduced to the CNN Goebbels-esque party line, had said that we're in impeachment territory now, but that the president had won a strong vote of confidence in the special election and deserves to take a victory lap. By this time, two on-running dramas absorbed American political attention, one foreign and one domestic. The foreign policy issue involved North Korea. Its communist dictator, Kim Jong-un, threatened to attack the United States territory of Guam, said his country could strike the west coast of the United States with nuclear weapons, and claimed to have developed a hydrogen bomb. As part of his continuing provocations in the region, he periodically fired missiles over the home islands of Japan. The Clinton administration had rewarded his father, Kim Jong-il, with more than $4 billion to discontinue his nuclear program, and he took the money and accelerated the program. The George W. Bush and Obama administrations engaged in purposeful negotiations, punctuated by righteous and even minatory noises. But North Korea continued to advance to the threshold of nuclear military capability. It was now Trump's problem, and North Korea either had to be accepted into the company of nuclear military powers or had to be discouraged from taking that step by more drastic diplomatic and economic measures than had been employed up to now, or prevented from doing so by preemptive military action. Trump, Vice President Pence, and Trump secretaries of state and defense repeatedly stated that they would not tolerate North Korea's acquisition of deliverable nuclear warheads. Trump had told the Chinese President Xi Jinping when they met in February that the United States would prevent North Korea from achieving this capability, preferably with the collaboration of the Chinese, but if necessary, unilaterally. He assured Jinping that the United States was not insisting on regime change in North Korea and was not seeking a united Korean peninsula, which China opposed as it would soon be another economic powerhouse almost of the proportions of Japan. But he forcefully repeated that a nuclear military North Korea was a non-starter. After a brief lapse, China, which had as much to fear from a nuclear North Korea as anyone, did finally turn the screws on exports and banking facilities and declared itself to be neutral in any conflict between North Korea and the United States. This was a good deal more cooperation than Beijing had furnished before, having spent decades nodding in agreement with the United States and Japan about North Korea, but impishly enabling its mischief. Though Trump's critics were almost predicting that he would provoke war with China, his achievement of the greatest diplomatic progress in the Far East since Nixon opened up relations with China has been almost unremarked. As always in the United States, there was the Peace Party calling for accommodation at any price, led by the imperishable Jimmy Carter, who thought relations would improve if the United States withdrew its forces from South Korea, and volunteered at the age of 92 to go to Pyongyang as American ambassador. He also volunteered, as someone who had voted for the socialist Bernie Sanders, that national press coverage of President Trump was very unfair and unbalanced, for which acknowledgement Trump publicly thanked him. Trump's enemies, of course, were not only in the media and the Democratic Party, but among many members of his own party, especially those who craved media adulation. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Robert Corker, for instance, claimed to believe that Trump could be a dangerous warmonger. Even so, Trump seemed to have created a diplomatic climate for stern action against North Korea. And there was a unanimous United Nations Security Council vote for sanctions. That would certainly not in itself constrain Kim, but it was a harbinger of firming international opinion. Inevitably, as time passed and the war of words escalated and the United States deployed increased forces to the theater, allies, foreign and domestic, quaked audibly at the knees. But Trump led effectively, and from early October, the public saber-rattling went quiet, and there were hopes that China was giving Kim a tutorial on where this could lead. Trump deployed 3 full aircraft carrier task forces, the immense nuclear carriers Nimitz, Theodore Roosevelt, and Ronald Reagan, just off North Korea, a serious show of strength. In domestic affairs, the drama of health care consumed the first 8 months of the administration. The Republicans in opposition had voted 7 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and had been vetoed by President Obama. Now that there was a president who would sign the bill to repeal it, it was more complicated. Trump, who had no background in the subject, took his Republican congressional colleagues seriously and assumed they knew what they were doing and meant what they said. Whatever the lack of rapport of many of them with him, they were presumably on the same side of this issue, and Trump had been assured that his Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Price, a doctor and a congressman, knew about health care and the state of congressional opinion. Price and Speaker Paul Ryan eventually produced a bill that rolled back the coercive aspects of Obamacare and ended the state monopolies of insurers. But it also rolled back Medicaid, which had millions of dependents, and it effectively deprived a significant number of people of health insurance, While it would reduce premiums for many more and would save the federal government substantial amounts of expense over the next decade. The Democrats went at once to their default position of howling hysterically that the Republicans were pandering to the rich and greedy and throwing the disadvantaged off the train, and spent around $20 million on a national advertising campaign whipping up opposition to Trump Care, as it was instantly called, though Trump was at first only sketchily aware of the bill's contents. The warning bells sounded when Ryan could not bring the bill to a vote. With tweaking and arm-twisting from the White House, it eased through and went to the Senate, but there it stopped. Health care was a shambles and would have to be addressed. On July 31st, Trump had the Republican senators to lunch at the White House and told them they looked like fools for their failure to reform health care after they had shouted from the housetops for 7 years that they would effect important changes. In modified forms, it came three times to the brink of adoption. In the end, the administration could only get 49 votes, as John McCain defected, apparently out of personal animus to Trump, thinly veiled behind tired pieties about cross-aisle compromise. Rand Paul was a libertarian perfectionist, but could only get 45 votes for his own bill, and Susan Collins of Maine voted against repeal because of issues proper to her state. The congressional Republicans were collectively exposed as frauds, cowards who had masqueraded as repealers, but folded like a $3 suitcase when it was their turn to legislate. It was a painful experience for Trump, but the game wasn't over. Secretary Price, having charged more than $400,000 in airplane charters, was disembarked by the president on September 29th. His tenure was a disappointment. Alex Azar, former head of the large pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly, replaced him. President and Mrs. Trump and a large entourage arrived in Warsaw for a state visit to Poland on July 5th. The following day, he was thunderously applauded by a large crowd that frequently broke into chants of "Donald Trump, Donald Trump," as he praised Polish courage and patriotism and pledged complete solidarity with his hosts, promising to deploy an anti-missile defense to protect Poland, a promise Obama had rescinded, and urging Russia to cease its destabilizing agitations. This was all rapturously received, and it at least shut up his domestic critics, who had complained that he had not explicitly endorsed the concept of "an attack upon one is an attack upon all" in his visit to the NATO headquarters at Brussels the previous month. But they immediately opened fire on another front, that because his speech included a rousing defense of Western civilization, he was a white nationalist and racist. The usual outrageous falsehoods from a media that could not even report rationally on a well-written, well-delivered, and well-received speech. He attended the Three Seas Conference of a group of 12 East European states that bordered the Adriatic, Black, or Baltic Seas. He proceeded on to Hamburg and the G20 meetings, which included private side meetings with many of the more prominent leaders, including Russia's Vladimir Putin, China's Xi Jinping, Britain's Theresa May, Germany's Angela Merkel, Japan's Shinzo Abe, Indonesia's President Joko Widodo, and France's Emmanuel Macron. He promised Mrs. May a swift passage of a free trade agreement should she wish to make one with the United States after exiting the European Union. On July 14th, he was in France to meet with Macron and review the traditional, formidable military parade the French put on along Paris's Champs-Élysées on their national day, July 14th. Chic and impeccable in Chanel and Dior couture, Melania Trump made an excellent impression. And Trump, whom the French, in their contrariness, had not greeted with as much pompous skepticism as the British and the Germans, was an exemplary visitor. Trump and Macron, populous with beguiling wives, seemed the only vital major Western leaders, with Merkel and Theresa May struggling with minority governments, and Italy in its usual state of disarray. Trump chivalrously complimented Madame Macron on her exemplary condition. She is 24 years older than her husband, which was taken by the French as a gracious remark, but disparaged by Trump's desperate enemies in the American media as verging on harassment. The country to which the president returned had been riled again, this time by the New York Times publication on July 9th of the news, that there had been a meeting between Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., then Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, and Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya during the campaign. Veselnitskaya had purportedly, according to the contact person, dangled damaging information about Hillary Clinton in order to get an audience with Trump's people. The real purpose of the meeting was almost certainly to lobby for the repeal of the Magnitsky Act, a U.S. law which has been effectively used to target and sanction close Putin allies following the death in Russian custody of Magnitsky, a reformist auditor and lawyer who alleged Russian crimes. As part of his campaign against the act, Putin rather spitefully passed a bill in 2012 banning the adoption of Russian children by American parents, a subject that evidently came up during the meeting. The president dictated a response from Air Force One dismissing the meeting as a discussion of the adoption of Russian children in the United States. The anti-Trumpers leapt to unwarranted conclusions with great speed. Hillary Clinton's vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine, even suggesting the trio were guilty of treason. Jared Kushner, who had an in-camera but much-praised meeting with the House Intelligence Committee on July 24th, was fully responsive to all questions and completely debunked any thought of collusion in the election with the Russians in his observations. This proved, in the parlance of the time, to be yet another flavorless nothing burger. But there continued to be unprecedented leaks from the White House, including the contents of conversations with foreign leaders and a good deal of semi-public backbiting among White House factions. On July 21st, outspoken Long Island financier Anthony Scaramucci was announced as White House Communications Director, and Sean Spicer, an amiable but not agile and often accident-prone person, retired as press secretary. Scaramucci promised to put some order into the press function and to staunch the leaks, if need be, by drastic measures. It was an auspicious start, but was blown up on July 28th by a catastrophic off-the-record interview with The New Yorker, one of the most Trump-hostile media outlets in the country, in which an apparently intoxicated Scaramucci, in the midst of the breakdown of his marriage when his wife was 9 months pregnant, uttered a number of extreme and very vulgar reflections on Steve Bannon, Reince Priebus, and some of his other colleagues. His comments were so intemperate and ill-considered, the media reported them almost without speculating on Scaramucci's likely fate, waiting for the president's response. The press feasted on this with bacchanalian glee, and Trump finally moved decisively to clean up the White House. On July 31st, Scaramucci walked the plank after only 16 days in the job and was replaced by yet another glamorous woman of the Trump entourage, Hope Hicks, the publicity-averse but media-effective 29-year-old former model. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, daughter of former governor of Arkansas and Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee, replaced Sean Spicer as press secretary. On August 18th, Steve Bannon, controversial campaign strategist, was eased out of the White House by mutual agreement and returned to Breitbart, his enterprising but not always reliable news website. Former party chairman Reince Priebus was moved out as chief of staff and replaced by Homeland Security Secretary and four-star Marine General John Kelly. He ran a tight ship, and the workplace atmosphere quickly improved, and there was a steady decline in indiscretions. In the midst of these tempestuous events, Trump announced that henceforth, transgender applicants would not be allowed into the armed forces. The whole status of transgendered people had been allowed to assume proportions out of all relation to their numbers under Obama, the ultimate manifestation of the inanities of identity politics. Trump believed that endless pandering to demographic subdivisions of the population was fragmenting the country. Given concerns about morale, readiness and medical costs associated with gender reassignment, the previous ban, he asserted, on transgender personnel, overridden by an Obama executive order, should be reinstated. Yet another activist judge intent on superseding the role of the executive branch, effectively making the commander-in-chief subordinate to the federal bench, banned the enforcement of Trump's order. After an initial appeal was unsuccessful, Trump declined to take it to the Supreme Court. On August 2nd, Trump announced his intention to reorient American immigration policy from giving priority to extended family reunification to a merit-based standard, where priority would be given to immigrants who could contribute well and quickly to American life. This was an emulation of the immigration policies of Canada and Australia, and while it raised Democratic hackles, it was well received in the country. Needless to say, it was not well received in the media, which went into collective hysterics about Trump.